I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Over the past few years, discussions about substance abuse have largely focused on the opioid epidemic. But when research shows that alcohol is responsible for 71% of substance use-related deaths in Barnstable County, it becomes apparent that we mustn't lose sight of the impacts of alcohol dependence and abuse. Later in the hour, we're going to focus on some different treatment options for alcohol abuse and dependence. But first, how big is the problem in our region? Joining us with information on the scope of the problem in Barnstable County is Vera Herrick. She's Senior Project Manager with the Barnstable County Department of Human Services. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
So the Barnstable County Regional Substance Abuse Council took a close look at substance use in the county and issued a report in March of 2015. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
Yes. Well, we used as an index year 2013, which is because of the lag in data availability. We found that we have an endemic, pernicious problem with alcohol abuse and addiction on Cape Cod, in addition to the other more prominently featured addictions in headlines, such as the opioid use and dependency problem. The alcohol use and addiction on the Cape is a endemic problem, and what that means is that it's a disease that's maintained in the population, and it doesn't increase or decrease particularly rapidly in one direction or another. And that's distinct from an epidemic, mm-hmm. which is a disease that spreads rapidly, has a rapid rate of increase, and is more noteworthy from a headline point of view. And that would characterize the opioid epidemic that we see now. Mm-hmm. I would characterize the alcohol problem as our baseline endemic, grinding, pernicious problem on the Cape.
So where did these stats come from? Where did you get these numbers?
How
did
these work? Are developed from local data, state of Massachusetts level addiction treatment, recovery data, some minor use of national statistics, but again, localized to our context here.
So these numbers actually could be a little bit higher because not everybody seeks treatment or,
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Not everyone presents to the treatment mm-hmm. system who has an addiction problem. I would say also that we recognize that the rates that we're using in the report are conservative. We tried to err on the side of conservatism, not to try and overstate the problem. But we feel like we're largely correct in this analysis.
Mm-hmm. We hear so much about overdose deaths from heroin, yet this is the number that shocked me. Alcohol accounted for 71% of substance use disorder-related deaths in Barnstable County, 14% from heroin. Why is that number so high?
Because more people on Cape Cod, as a raw number, have an alcohol addiction problem. And if you have a problem that has lethal consequences at its as part of its course, the more people have it, the more deaths you will have from that. We have about between 15,000 to 16,500 people on Cape Cod who are addicted to alcohol. This isn't people who use alcohol, which is a far higher percentage, of course, mm-hmm. but a good 15,000 people are addicted to alcohol, and with a death rate that comes from alcohol use and associated deaths from cancers and strokes and so on, you very easily work up to a number of deaths that mm-hmm. are greatly in excess of the deaths that we are seeing from opioid and opioids, fentanyl, and so on.
Do we know about the demographics of those with alcohol abuse disorder, men versus women in age? Do we have that information?
Typically, our colleagues here might know more at a more granular level, but it typically breaks two-thirds, one-third men, women.
Mm-hmm. What about our statistics compared to national statistics? Are they?
We are a bit higher.
A bit higher?
In Massachusetts, mm-hmm. we're a bit higher. I would say, 20%, a good 20% mm-hmm. higher. If the national statistic is about 5.9% of people at risk for alcohol abuse are in fact addicted, the Massachusetts rate was recently found at around 8%. Mm-hmm. And that's the figure we're using here on Cape. It could be higher here. Mm-hmm. There are people who have argued that the problem on the Cape is in fact a bit more widespread than you would find statewide.
The report from the Regional Substance Abuse Council also took a look at the financial costs for substance abuse. What was the breakdown in terms of how money was spent on what substances?
That's a great question. In addition to looking at the epidemiology, which is the numbers of people afflicted with various substance use problems, we tried to estimate the costs associated with the substance use epidemic, the substance use problem on Cape Cod. And when we worked up the numbers from the costs associated with treatment, with recovery, with the courts having to deal with the problem, police forces, and so on, we wound up with a figure of about $110 million per year, and this is in 2013, associated with substance use problems on Cape Cod. And that's the amalgamation of the costs that are seen in the system from a variety of different points of view: the direct costs, policing, the courts, treatment, recovery. A very small percentage for prevention, less than 1% is spent on prevention, where as a public health person, I would argue a vastly larger amount of money needs to be invested.
It would certainly be the prevention dollars are certainly less than the treatment dollars.
If you there's an order of magnitude
cost effective
difference.
So was there something that surprised you in the findings? Was this what you were expecting, or did something jump out at you?
The magnitude of the impact of alcohol on our population surprised me. I mean, to understand the substance use problem in Cape Cod, you have to, the metaphor I use is it's a canvas. Alcohol is that canvas on which the other vignettes of more localized problems, other substances come and go, are painted and then removed and replaced by others. But unless we address an alcohol problem, a misuse and abuse problem on Cape Cod, we're not going to make major inroads into preventing the so-called harder substances that are used in our problem.
Right. Vera Herrick, Senior Project Manager at the Barnstable County Department of Human Services. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing this with us. Now joining the conversation, Suzanne Robbins is Director of Clinical Operations at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning, Mindy.
Diane Wells, Nurse Practitioner at Mashpee Family Medicine with an interest in women in recovery. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Ray Tomasi, present CEO of Gosnold. Good morning, Ray.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, so I guess we should start with how do we define addiction to alcohol? What does that look like? Who wants to jump in there?
This is Suzanne Robbins. I'm more than happy to talk a little bit about that. Alcohol dependence is when you have withdrawal symptoms, you can't stop drinking, whether it's for mental, behavioral, or physiologic reasons. Alcohol abuse is when you drink alcohol for coping with different issues in your life, you engage in high-risk behaviors, you continue to drink alcohol, even when it does have a negative impact on your work, your relationships, and other aspects of your life.
Mm-hmm. Anybody want to add anything to that?
Well, I think, this is Diane Wells, I think that the biggest piece of this would be, continuing to drink against your will when you know that you want and need to stop despite negative consequences.
Mm-hmm. According to a 2014 study in the CDC journal Preventing Chronic Disease, 9 in 10 adults who drink too much alcohol are not alcoholics or alcohol dependent. That study suggests that contrary to popular opinion, most people who drink too much are not alcohol dependent or alcoholics. Is that right? So you can drink too much and not be an alcoholic?
Absolutely. You can turn it off.
Yeah.
You can stop and stay stopped. When there's an issue with alcoholism, you can't stay stopped.
What defines a heavy drinker and what defines a binge drinker?
Well, I mean, the term binge, implies the periods of heavy use over short periods of time. and that's, typically that's been referred to when talking about college kids. There are a lot of binge drinking in college kids. I think the problem that we have is in trying to sort of pinpoint when does something become something else is a little bit problematic, because if you think about how we characterize other conditions, chronic conditions, I dare say, this is not my area of expertise, but I don't know when a person with high blood pressure becomes diagnosed as a hypertensive. At some point, they make a decision that you have hypertension. But that hypertension is preceded by a period where blood pressure is fluctuating. And so from my perspective, there are certain risk factors that would make a hypertensive person or an alcohol dependent person much more likely to be identified earlier because of certain risk factors. Genetics is the primary thing, actually. Mm-hmm. So family history, adverse childhood experiences, there are a number of things that we know predispose people, either environmental, genetic, health history. We do a very poor job of that, and we're very focused on identifying people when they become essentially sort of stage three in dependency, where the addiction, frankly, could be diagnosed by almost a layperson. So if other people think that your drinking is interfering with functioning, then you probably have a problem. Mm-hmm. But that's not a very refined or sophisticated observation. You know, so the culture is pretty much sort of inured to anything other than acuity. And that's true even in the opiate thing. It's a little bit different, but it's overdose deaths that precipitated this hue and cry that something has to be done. We're in the 18th year of the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. It began in 99. Nobody thought it was a crisis until white middle class mm-hmm. kids started to die. So everything is sort of tilted that way. I can tell you that when we went into hospital emergency rooms to do interventions with opiate overdose admissions, the ER chief of the emergency medicine said, well, it's great, but we have 3 to 4 times as many alcohol-related issues in this emergency room. And so many of the people we're seeing there are alcohol-dependent, whether they're there for a related mm-hmm. experience or not. So I think, you know, Vera's point and Diane's about women is particularly a concerning in the current environment. That, you know, because there was a report that came out just a week or two ago that among women in the, I think it's 25 to 34 or mm-hmm. 30 to 40, that there's been a doubling of alcohol-related deaths amongst that population. Constitutes 8% of deaths for women in that age group are alcohol-related. Mm-hmm. Those don't find their way to the top of the page in the media.
And as a medical person, you know, what I've been trying to do is make sure that it is very clear that alcoholism is a disease process. Mm-hmm. It is a disease. It's not a moral issue. It's not an issue of weakness. It is a disease process. And just like hypertension or heart disease, people are predisposed to this disease. And when I do a physical exam, one of my questions is, you know, do you have a family history of alcoholism? How much and how often do you drink? How do you feel about your drinking? And has anybody spoken to you about your drinking? Does it impact your life? This is a disease that needs to be dealt with on a disease level, because most of us, other than people who are really in tuned with it, will point fingers at women because, you know, you're weak. You should know better. You're a mother. You're a daughter. And that keeps women underground, because women do not have the enzyme to break down alcohol, which is why it's so much more deadly in women.
Mm-hmm. That was going to be my question. Does it process differently in men and women? And it does.
Right? It does.
Yeah. All right. So, go ahead.
So to Ray and Diane's point, you know, the whole point of recognizing somebody who has a problem with alcohol, we're doing it a far too late mm-hmm. time in the process. One of the things we're doing at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod is we're doing on every patient at their annual exam, we're doing a screening and brief intervention for alcohol and drug dependence. Mm-hmm. So it's called an ESPERT, and we do that on everybody who comes in.
Is that questions?
It's a questionnaire, mm-hmm. and it's related to people who might have a problem with alcohol and or drugs. Mm-hmm. So there's further work that's done by the primary care providers once they see the results of the ESPERT. Mm-hmm. So just to kind of identify
Do
that.
Do you find people are honest when they are asked those questions for the most part?
No.
I think it's important to comment about that. Now, why? See, because would someone ask that question about a level of inquiry with another condition? I'm not so sure they would. And well, I there's an inherent, and I understand why, but I think it contributes to the whole sort of surround of mystery and stigma and shame and guilt. You know, so the assumption would be if you ask a question about your alcohol use, that the patient is probably lying. We probably, well, but I mean, they may or may not. It's in the eye of the beholder. When we did work in a hospital, we did a pilot project in a hospital for a couple, 2 or 3 years, and we examined the way that the staff asks the questions when they do sort of pre-op physicals and things like that. I just had a minor surgical procedure. Never asked me if I used alcohol. They asked the guy in the next stall. I heard him, and he said, well, I have a couple. And his wife was in the stall with him. He said, well, actually, you may have 3 or 4. So I was going to do an intervention on that guy, but I was preoccupied with my own issues. So the hospital, the staff was saying, they'd go through the thing and I'd say, do you smoke? Yes, no. Do you drink? Yes, no. And move right on. So we helped them sort of reframe those questions and explain to people why it was important for the patient to be candid, because what was happening is patients would go in for a surgical procedure.
DTs.
Right? And then they'd go into withdrawal when they come out of surgery. They'd be in the hospital for 2 weeks in a procedure where they should be there for 3 days. And most of the patients we saw in the hospital did not have an alcohol-related diagnosis. They had a condition that was related to alcohol, GI problems, GI conditions mostly. But there was no alcoholism in their diagnosis at all.
But I think, you know, we do it as part of our basic assessment because we're assessing for many other things. We'll do an A1C to assess for problems with prediabetes, you know, that. So we're doing, you know, blood pressure, diabetes, alcohol, drugs. It's all part of
it. It's part of it. It's not something that's like, sure, now I'm going to ask you about things that I'd really rather not ask you about.
But it's really important for it to be part of that assessment of your patients.
And judgment-free. I mean, I've noticed at, you know, the emergency rooms, people with any kind of addiction, whether it be alcohol or opiates, you know, they're judged. The shame, the blame, the guilt. And nobody's going to tell the truth under those circumstances.
Right.
You just want to know. So and what I usually frame it as, now, this question is sometimes uncomfortable, but we just need to know to give you the best care possible.
We are talking about alcohol abuse and dependence. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about alcohol abuse and dependence. With us in studio is Diane Wells, nurse practitioner at Mashpee Family Medicine with an interest in women in recovery. Suzanne Robbins is director of clinical operations at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. And Ray Tomasi is president and CEO of Gosnold. So what are some of the reasons people can drink heavily but not become addicted while others do become dependent?
I think the biggest piece is genetics.
Mm-hmm.
Genetics. You know, some people can drink very little and become addicted. Genetics and sex, you know, and gender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I think is a big piece of it. You know, some people can drink, quote unquote, heavily and have no problem. Like I said earlier, they can turn it off. They can drink at holidays and then not at all or at special occasions. Whereas other people can, you know, can drink every day and still not have an issue.
Mm-hmm. Also, how your body reacts to alcohol is different for different people. I know I can think of a friend. She'll have half a beer, and she seems like she's had a whole six-pack. You know, it's like it just reacts in her differently than it might in somebody else. So what about alcohol use as a sign of underlying behavioral health issues such as depression or anxiety? And how does alcohol exacerbate or complicate some of these behavioral health problems?
Well, it complicates and exacerbates almost all of them, really. I think it's an area of, you know, it has been an area of controversy over the years because for many years, many clinicians were treating patients with alcoholism or alcohol use disorder, whatever the current frame of phrase is, with the idea that the person is doing this behavior for a particular reason and there's some underlying pathology that's driving it. And if we can get to that underlying pathology, then this symptom, drinking, will go away. And that was an abject failure, actually, to approach a separate identifiable disease in that way as being a symptom of something else. Now, having said that, you know, there are any number of factors that would precipitate a person discovering that alcohol or any drug, you know, relieves psychic distress, whether it's, but it could be something as, you know, as innocent really as being able to talk to a girl or boy at a dance when you're in high school, you know, and you find out that you have a couple of beers, you have a little nip in the boys' room before, and suddenly you're not as concerned about whether you're going to be rejected. And that's only because of the way alcohol is changing your cognitive functioning. So this business of, now when a person gets to the point of saying, well, we need to treat this condition, and invariably, if you have, you know, sort of drugged your sensibilities over a period of time, then you become less able to cope with the things that would precipitate a depression or anxiety or something else. And so typically those things need to be dealt with. Normally, in sort of the normal case, if you will, you would address the addiction, and then as the person begins to experience recovery and life without alcohol, then some of these other things are going to surface and you deal with them. In other cases, those conditions are as severe as the alcoholism. So you have this reference to a co-occurring disorder, and you may need to treat both of them at the same time. So it isn't a one-size-fits-all situation. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I was just thinking, you know, to speak to Ray's point that, you know, most people that I have seen who have the who have severe anxiety, who have depression, you know, they are co-occurring, you know, disorders that need to be addressed. And a lot, and oftentimes people have other things like eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And once you treat one, the other one goes spiraling downward. So, you know, it's very, I think it's very important as clinicians to try to identify all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And work with them all simultaneously, because, you know, what good is treating the alcoholism if the eating disorder is going to kill them?
Right. I think you also see people who don't have severe anxiety or severe mental health issues, when they're in recovery, when people are in recovery and they have a little bit of anxiety, which is normal. I mean, that's normal in our lives. I hear the clinicians saying all the time, it's okay to be anxious because everybody gets anxious at times, and we have to learn how to deal with that in other ways.
I'm wondering, too, what your thoughts are on how the examples we set for kids. We recently did a program where we talked about this, how, you know, if you go home and, you know, you either pop the beer or you give the glass of wine, you know, you're kind of giving your kid the message, this is how I deal with stress. Rather, I think the suggestion was you walk in the house, you go, hey, I'm just going to go over in the corner and do a little yoga, or who wants to go for a walk with me? And I think these are things we don't really think so much about what examples we're setting for our kids. So what are your thoughts on how we educate kids, not only about alcohol, but substance abuse in general? I think we had a pediatrician on who said, if you can make it to age 25 not having had any drugs or alcohol, then you have a less than 1% chance of becoming a
That's probably true. Yeah. I mean, that's been shown to be true by research. I mean, you're asking a question that goes, you know, to the heart of the culture of America. You know, if you think, I'm not great on movie people, but there's a movie where, what's that girl's name? Schumer, I think.
Schumer?
Yeah. Chug-a-lugs, some of this boxed wine thing called Bandit. Mm-hmm. In the movie, in the next month, sales of that boxed wine jumped by 22%, mostly young women.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this imitative sort of a behavior. I mean, your question goes to such a cultural thing. I mean, you know, there are differences in Europe. There's a different sort of culture about alcohol and its integration into society in a different kind of way. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we ever get there.
Yeah.
And as, you know, as a mother of two now adult women who grew up in a sober home, you know, it's leading by example more than anything. You know, they grew up knowing that there were sober substitutes. They grew up knowing that they could go to a cookout. One of my daughters said, we go to this woman's house for a cookout and we never have to worry that there's beer in the cooler.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, for my children, from my standpoint, it was just how they grew up.
Yeah.
That's very different from how I grew up.
Well, modeling. You know, what's the root? Yeah, the modeling. Mm-hmm. What's the root of a behavioral addiction, sort of. You know, when somebody isn't physiologically addicted to alcohol, doesn't go into withdrawal, but feels like that's the way they live their life. That's the way they cope with work. That's stress. That's the way they do everything. So how do you, you know, that, where does that come from?
And alcohol dependence can occur at any point in life. I was thinking of someone who was retired, and she said the advice she got was, don't make him lunch and don't drink before five.
Yeah.
Right, so it can happen at any point.
Well, that's one, I think that's one of the things that I, you know, is not well understood, or maybe it is. It's just that the sequencing of this is not entirely predictable. It's predictable, but the time frame within which it will occur and the speed with which it will come on and you know affect the person is not really known. I mean, you know, folks. The Cape, I don't know that the Cape is any different than a lot of other similar communities. You know, I always hear the Cape has the highest. When I came here in the 70s, it was the Cape Cod at the highest alcoholism rate in the country. I'm like, that's not even possible. But so you have people who are living lives, going to work, they're in a community, and then they retire. And they drink, they have a cocktail, they go to a party or a thing. Then they come to the Cape, they retire. And there are a lot of life circumstances that sort of get converged into a small piece of time. Now you're living a more sedentary life. Your sense of purpose is maybe dissipated. You're in a different place. You're not with the same people. And alcohol was part of your life back then. Then you have more occasions when you may drink. So we do see the onset of, age-related alcohol dependence coming later in life. So on the other hand, we've seen 18-year-old kids that look like they've been through every symptom in 3 years.
Wow. Susanna, the Community Health Center of Cape Cod in Mashpee, that offers a substance abuse program for patients. So tell us more about the different programs you offer for people specifically with alcohol dependence.
So we do have a medication-assisted therapy program and addictions program, treatment program at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. We do have three sites. You can be seen in the Bourne site or the Mashpee site at this point in time. We do prescribe for opiate addiction, but we also prescribe Vivitrol, which can be used for alcohol or opiates. It basically blocks the effects. Vivitrol blocks the effects of the alcohol. It doesn't prevent the motor or physiological effects. Mm-hmm. It blocks the positive effects of the alcohol. It's an injection that you get once a month. You can be engaged in using Vivitrol or being treated with Vivitrol for, we have some people, for up to a year. But in our program, it's an integrated program. Mm-hmm. So you need to see your primary care to take care of yourself physically. We also require people to have group or individual counseling. Mostly we do group counseling, and it's part of our integrated program. It's covered by insurance, mm-hmm. Even MassHealth.
So it's available to anybody.
Anybody.
Regardless of their ability to pay?
Correct. Regardless of ability to pay. So,
And then I'll say, Ray, I mean, a lot of people have heard of Gosnold, but tell us the services Gosnold has.
Well, I think all the traditional things. I mean, Suzanne mentioned group counseling, individual counseling. We use medications. The medications for addiction, whether it's alcohol or opiate, are still in a very, I think, primitive stage. They're only three for opiates. There are several for alcohol. We use naltrexone. We've used Campral. The results are mixed. And one of the issues with medication is always maintaining compliance and understanding that there isn't really a medication that in and of itself will eliminate the need for the other psychosocial therapies. Not yet. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work going on in that area. I think that's where you'll see most of the gains in addiction, in the treatment of addiction over the next 10 to 20 years will be in the pharmaceutical area. I've been introduced to this guy. I don't know what he's talking about most of the time, but he does pharmacogenetics where we're looking at certain people with genes that will enable them to respond better to one medication than another. Because right now, everybody either gets Suboxone or they get Vivitrol. If it's opiates or we give Campral or naltrexone, they're relatively benign medication and maybe they'll help. And they do help some people, but we don't really know which medications are best matched to individuals. And I think that's where the research and some of the brain stuff that's going on in neuroscience is going to bring advances. Otherwise, we haven't had significant advances in the treatment of addiction. I mean, we're doing a lot with technology and trying to stay connected to people out of the traditional treatment venues. I think the place where we've really not done well enough is that we wait until people are in crisis and need an acute service that day. That's why we have an access problem, because anyone who calls needs to get treatment that day. Right. It's just not possible to do. So we have to get much better. And the kinds of things that are going on with Diane and Suzanne in the general health world is where we really need to go. Mm-hmm. Identify earlier, intervene earlier, and prevent crises.
Right. And Diane, I want to ask you, there's also free community meeting programs such as AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. Can you explain the structure of the program in that 12-step process?
The 12-step process is, believes, the premise is that it's a body, mind, and spirit issue. And that piece has to be looked at and dissected, and then you come back together. Mm-hmm. And I think that, that's kind of really bringing it down to a basic level. It's available. It's, free of charge for anybody who can't pay. And it is readily available. Mm-hmm. And it offers support as well as a way to look at how and why you drink.
Go ahead.
Can I just want to say one other thing? I'm like fortunate, sometimes not fortunate, to be in a lot of other parts of the country and talk to people about what they're doing. And it always needs to be said in this kind of setting that the things that are going on here on the Cape, particularly Massachusetts generally, but on the Cape, are really the envy of so many other communities. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think just about what we're doing here today. We've got a community health center that's really reshaping the way we deliver health care and bringing in behavioral, I hate that word, but it's what we're stuck with, behavioral health into the mainstream medicine. You have a person like Diane with expertise who's able to engage patients in this conversation while she's talking about other things. And you have all these other, whether it's interventions, support groups, recovery centers, the use of medications, the community coalitions around prevention, and all of these things. It's really remarkable what's happening here. And we should give ourselves, and of course, with the Regional Substance Abuse Council, with the sectors of the community that typically are not interested, but we have that on the Cape. It's a very robust environment that gives people opportunities to get better, and they do get better.
Yeah. Coming up after break, we're going to discuss some more different treatment options for alcohol abuse and dependence. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about alcohol abuse and dependence and options for treatment. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with us is Suzanne Robbins, Director of Clinical Operations at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, Diane Wells, Nurse Practitioner at Mashpee Family Medicine, and Ray Tomasi, President and CEO of Gosnold. So, what I'm getting from this is there are lots of different options, but talk about the importance of this comprehensive treatment. It's not just one thing.
The comprehensive piece, really, that's the crux of it. The addiction is a body, mind, and spirit disease, and the medication alone is not enough. With my patients, I really push the fact that, you've got to have a therapist. You've got to do that and the sober substitute piece, yoga, meditation, whatever your spiritual practice is, that along with medication and or a 12-step recovery program, is key in getting better. Mm-hmm. And but my issue and downside is the access piece.
Right.
I can get, I can help anybody. As Ray said, people can be ready for treatment and there's no bed. There's no way in. Luckily, I've been in this community long enough that I can call and say, look, I need a favor. Mm-hmm. And Ray has been wonderful with that over the years. They might have to sleep on a cot, but they're in, safe.
Yeah. Right, let's talk to Tim Lineweaver, who's the senior clinician at the director of Recovering Champions. Good morning, Tim. I'll spit it out.
Good morning.
Recovering Champions offers a variety of substance abuse treatment programs. What's the treatment philosophy behind your approach?
Well, it's essentially, it's not unlike what your other guests have been discussing this morning. It's sort of a holistic approach, body, mind, spirit, as Diane was talking about. It's essential that we approach any addiction, including alcoholism, in a comprehensive way. Often trauma is the engine that drives addiction. The focus of Recovering Champions is really related to co-occurring disorders. So what that means is somebody having a substance abuse disorder co-occurring with another mental health issue like depression, PTSD, and what have you. And that's sort of one of the cornerstones of our program, is we're trying to link that up with the 12 steps.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing we really haven't talked much about is the impact on the family. And you have program options for family members.
Absolutely. I mean, it's some people say it's a family disease. Certainly, my experience, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My father struggled with trauma and was what we would call sort of a chronic alcoholism, and ultimately he died from the disease. One of the things that makes alcohol so destructive is the impairment of a person's judgment when they're drinking. In an alcoholic home, to live with an alcoholic is most likely to be traumatized. As is often the case, I grew up and developed my own addictive disorders, including alcoholism as well. I was fortunate to, get treatment when I was relatively young, at about 28, been in recovery since then. And those experiences have really informed my work, and I think that, a lot of people at Recovering Champions are in recovery, and we take the focus of 12 steps. We attach psychiatry. There's a medical component here as well. We do practice a lot of wellness, so all of that is sort of wrapped up in the work that we do here. Yeah.
Is your program covered by most insurance companies? And the last time we spoke, you were in the process of getting Recovery Champions covered by MassHealth. Where do you stand now?
We're midstream with that. They've got all our information, and we're kind of tapping our foot, waiting for them to get back to us.
All right.
I'm sure they will, but that's been a somewhat slow process.
Okay, we'll have a link for more information about Recovering Champions at our website, capeandislands.org. Tim Lineweaver, thanks so much for joining us. And I think I want to make a point here about recovery, because, a lot of times we hear the stories about what's happening on the abuse side, but there are loads and loads of wonderful recovery stories and sitting right here in this room.
Yeah. Life is amazing in recovery, and it is a day-to-day process. It's, it's like any other disease. If you don't take your medicine on a daily basis, the disease comes back,
right?
Because it's always waiting, just like hypertension, heart disease. I tell my patients, if you had diabetes and didn't take your insulin, what would happen?
Yeah. And I think probably for many people that hardest part is, you get into recovery and here you are, with your friends and in the same situations you were before you went for whatever treatment you're in. And that's got to be really difficult, changing those habits where, you can have some fun without drinking. And that, I would imagine, takes a different amount of time for different people, right?
It does. Yeah. But you can have fun without drinking, period, and lots of fun. It's just a different way of thinking. I just don't drink,
mm-hmm.
And my life is amazing. I just came back from a 10-day trip to the Caribbean. Life doesn't stop because you're not drinking.
Some people say it starts when you
start. Exactly.
All right, let's talk to Bill Doherty, who's Executive Director of Recovery Without Walls. Bill, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to hear you guys. Some great stuff this morning.
So, Bill, yours is a free program that's geared toward women in recovery. So describe some of the services that you offer.
We offer basically sort of a bridge for women coming out of substance abuse treatment or from the community. And basically we start with the basics. I mean, alcoholism and addiction are comfort diseases. They're really, and until you can learn to be able to shift that comfort to something else, then you really can't make a lot of progress. So, as you know, we use acupuncture almost all the time to try to shift the comfort of the brain. And what we find out is after a while that that begins to happen, and it's much easier, you know, to deal with the women we work with.
Yeah, it's interesting because we did a program, as you know, last time we talked to you, we talked about this using acupuncture basically to ease some of that anxiety. And you've been having some pretty great results. Tell us what some of the women are telling you about this.
Well, what we do is we have two programs, one in the community and one working with the Emerson House program, part of Gosnold. And what we do from the time we put them in, and we've changed a little bit, we're also asking people to find more holistic methods, especially adding more B vitamins into their life, entering magnesium, all the stuff you can get at health food stores. And for years, we used in the treatment of in detox and alcohol. So going back to simple things, and we have the person check in, meet with us here, or send us about a paragraph every week of where they are. The other thing we do is try to, as far as comfort, is remove the immediate problem, especially around financial. Put a place to live over your head. Create safety for the person. And, you know, we've been very successful in doing that because we're self-funded, so we can do sort of immediate stuff, you know, that other folks are sort of hampered by.
And tell us why you focus just on women and not men.
The reason, basically, that we did was when I was, for the last 30 years working in treatment in various hospitals, that women tended to do very well in treatment. And yet the day they left would go back to the same situations. And it just, you know, dawned on me when we started this, when I was working for Gosnold TSS, that it takes long-term case management. And with women, one of the things that we see is with women, after a while, there is more willingness to change in the first year if they are successfully case managed and made to feel safe. Mm-hmm.
Bill, Recovery Without Walls offers other complementary services for other treatments. What are some of the other programs that you are seeing that women are having success with?
One of the ones, if you look at the front page of the Cape Cod Times, there's a program we're doing. One of the things that we believe in is from the immediate time that you get involved is to be community-oriented. So we have a program right now across the Cape giving out gift cards to first responders on the Cape. And the idea being that many of the women we work with have been in situations that may be domestic, they may have been Narcan from an opiate problem. So what we do is say, okay, immediately when you come here, you have to then become part of what we are and then go out and do a community service. So we do five major ones a year. And now we're doing this one, so the person immediately begins to feel part of the community. And that's really worked for us, everything from classical music to volleyball.
We'll have a link with more information about Recovery Without Walls at our website, capeandislands.org. Bill, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Sure. We have an email from a listener. Amy says, according to the CDC, there is no safe amount of alcohol that a woman can use during pregnancy and even when trying to become pregnant. This speaks what you were saying, yes. Diane, about women, how they
metabolize it. Yeah. It is correct. That is correct. You know, fetal alcohol syndrome is something that, you know, can be avoided, can be prevented. There is no safe amount of alcohol. What I tell my patients who are trying to become pregnant or are pregnant, imagine your baby in a baby seat. Would you hand him a drink? Would you hand him a cigarette?
So getting back to the recovery question, are there common triggers that cause relapses? I mean, are you finding that there's... You know, is it sometimes it's going home to that same situation? What causes somebody? And some people relapse and then do fine the next time around. So just because you relapse once doesn't mean that you can't beat this.
Well, that's another one of my pet things, and it is. You know, the whole idea that this is the only disease I know of that's referred to as a chronic relapsing disease. I mean, there are other chronic diseases, but they don't use that adjective, relapsing disease. And I think the whole idea of relapse, or what I prefer to call it as a regression, is part of any expectation around chronic conditions. We never expect a patient with diabetes to go their entire life and never have a spike in the blood sugar. We deal with those in the context of their progressing, the ups and downs of life and health. And I think that we've categorize this relapse thing as something that defines either the person's unwillingness or reluctance or denial or inability to actually get honest with themselves. It's so primitive. And we've categorized treatment as being unsuccessful if someone goes to treatment and comes out. Now, we know, and I think to Bill Daugherty's point, we know that simply going to a detox or a detox and a rehab is totally insufficient. We would never do that with any other condition. And the one of the things is the social determinants that impact things like regressions are so important that need to be paid attention to. We would always do care management post-hospitalization with patients who are coming out, and we're doing a lot more of that as the payment system changes in general health care. And that's really one of the keys, I think, to helping patients stay better longer. Mm-hmm. To get away from this fallacy of you're going to be able to go, because everybody does pretty well in rehab. We have one of the highest sort of what they call treatment completion rates in the state for people who go to rehab. Well, you go to rehab, you go to fitness, you go to meals, you go to group, you get up in the morning, somebody does, and it's not great. Nobody really wants to be there, but it's not awful, and they do pretty well. I'm always concerned with what happens 48 to 72 hours after you leave that setting. Mm-hmm. That's the critical. And it's not just that 2 or 3 days. It's what happens in the week or the 2 weeks after. And how do we create connections? And you can't do it simply with people. I mean, we do a lot of things with our recovery coaching program. We got 12 or 15 of these folks that run around, and they're helping a lot of people. So we need to be really creative about how we do that, how we maintain contact. Technology holds great promise for that. It's not enough to go to see Ray or Diane or Suzanne on Tuesday the 10th and then come back on Tuesday the 23rd. What happens? I'm always curious about what happens between the 10th and the 23rd. That's how you prevent those setbacks.
Good.
So another program that's recent to the Cape is the Smart Recovery Program. Smart Recovery is motivational based. They have like 4 tenets that talks about building and maintaining motivation, coping with urges, maintaining thoughts, feelings, and behavior, and basically living a balanced life. It's an adjunct to AA. You can go to it at the same time. You can use this program instead of AA. But it's a cognitive behavior therapy program, which talks about what to do during that week between your visits or, you know, and how to manage.
It targets the people that have trouble with the whole spiritual thing.
Right, it's secular.
I'm wondering about stigma. You know, we talk about the opiate addiction and not carrying a lot of stigma, but alcohol is more socially accepted. Do we see stigma associated with alcohol addiction and treatment? I would say yeah.
Oh, right? Absolutely. Yeah. Especially with women, which is my great love. Women, you should know better. You're a mother, you're a daughter, you're a teacher, you're this, that, or the other. But, that just taps into the moral issue. Alcoholism is not a moral issue. It's a disease. And once we start shifting the thinking that it is a disease that needs to be treated on a body, mind, and spirit basis, I think we'll begin to get somewhere. We'll do the baby steps.
Go ahead, real quick.
I think the thing that makes stigma with alcoholism worse is that 9 out of 10 people who drink alcohol can do so without incident.
Mm-hmm, right.
And that makes the 1 out of 10 really weird. Yeah. Like, what's with you?
Stand out.
All right. With Diane Wells, Suzanne Robbins, Ray Tomasi, thank you so much for being here. We'll have links for more information at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.